Welcome to Modern Architecture. Make sure you're on slide one, the emergence of modern materials and modern architecture. In the 19th century, iron, steel, and concrete became both less costly and more widely available, and so they came into common architectural use. New possibilities emerged as architects began to examine new ways to control tension and compression. Buildings could be built taller and in different configuration. Architects could find exciting new ways to distribute the stress forces in their buildings. New types of buildings emerged and new materials made buildings look radically different. So one of the first modern innovations is cast iron architecture, which we don't have any particular sites that utilize this, but it's kind of a precursor to steel frame construction, which we're going to get to next. So cast iron had been available since ancient times. But it wasn't until the 18th century that artisans and craftsmen could produce enough cast iron in order to have the quantities able to make a building. So this is kind of an important aspect of the Industrial Revolution, is that cast iron could be made in mass quantities. And that was definitely a technical innovation for buildings. Walls and roof could be supported with a cast iron structure. And you could build monumental structures with, I don't want to say less materials, but with a more efficient economic material. So the use of cast iron for construction opened up new possibilities for architects. Cast iron was stronger than wood and more flexible than stone, so it could be shaped into any form and it was cheap. Iron ore was very plentiful. And so from that, steel becomes a material that's widely used. And the reason steel connects to cast iron is because steel is a material that's made from iron, and you add in a small quantity of carbon. Now, the benefit of that is it's actually stronger than pure iron and has even greater potential. So this kind of takes us to our first architect. So one architect who noted the advantages of steel was Louis Sullivan, who was known as the father of modernism. So you can go ahead and move to slide two, and we're going to talk about the beginnings of the skyscraper. So Louis Sullivan is known as the father of modernism in terms of architecture, and he became a pioneer in the creation of the modern skyscraper itself. Sullivan attended Massachusetts Institute of Technology at the age of 16 and took his first architect job at 17. He participated in the rebuilding of Chicago after the Great Fire in Chicago of 1871. Chicago provided fertile ground for creative young architects like Sullivan. And in Chicago, Sullivan pushed the use of steel frame to new heights. So to accomplish his lofty goals to kind of rebuild and utilize iron in a way never before, he really made sure to create structures that depended on proportional relationships between the parts and the whole. And Sullivan carefully calibrated his designs. So one of his most impressive developments occurred in Chicago, where after the Great Fire of 1871, the majority of the city was leveled. During the closing decades of the century, the city had a rapid increase in population, and that increase in population spawned a huge building boom. Sullivan's last major commission was a design for the Schlesinger and Meyer department store, now known as the Carson Peary Scott Building, which is the label you guys will have in the 250. The idea of having a huge urban store carrying luxury items for middle and upper class patrons was novel. It was something like brand new to this urban area. And Sullivan emphasized elegant public entrances and huge plate glass windows on the lower floor by fantastic cast iron ornamentation of his own design. The upper floors with their huge Chicago windows and very plain terracotta decoration, which we'll get into detail a little bit later, refer in a streamlined fashion to the concealed steel cage. But note that the horizontal members are emphatically wider and therefore dominant, meaning that essentially that this building, although it's very tall and it's in the category of skyscrapers, it still has kind of a horizontal quality to it that definitely dominates the facade. Sullivan's sensitivity to the shape and placement of the building as a whole is evident with the cylindrical tower he has in the center, It's an unexpected element, adding a vertical punctuation mark that makes the horizontal sides even more forceful. Here, Sullivan completely avoids any historical references, creating a building that's one of the first works of modern architecture. You can go ahead and move to slide 3, and we're going to talk a little bit about like his philosophy of buildings, because when we talk about modern architects, it's not just about creating a building for status or power. We are moving into kind of an area of art where the artists have concepts and ideas that tie into how why the buildings look the way that they look. So when you're looking at this building, it's carefully constructed. It was constructed in 2 stages. As I mentioned before, it's an important example of early Chicago skyscraper architecture. And it also has an interesting relationship between architecture and commerce that we'll get into when we talk about the ground floor in a couple slides. The firm of Adler & Sullivan first became known in Chicago in the early 1880s for basically the design of an auditorium building. There's other landmarks that utilize new methods of steel frame construction and kind of created this unique American blend of simplified monumentality. So in the mid-1890s, Sullivan wrote his own treatise on skyscraper architecture, and it was titled The Tall Office Building Artistically Considered. In this treatise, and remember, a treatise is basically like a proclamation of like how to do something at length. The last time I think we talked about treatises was when we looked at contrapposto and doryphorus and canons and things like that. So what you would expect in a treatise is it's going to basically make a statement about like how to do something. And in this case, how do you build a tall office building with artistic considerations in mind? So in this book, Sullivan analyzed the problem of creating a high-rise commercial piece of architecture. And he argued with his famous phrase, and his main claim, like anytime you hear Sullivan, the architect, he has like a famous line. And that famous line is, form must ever follow function. Meaning that the way that a building looks should definitely be a product of how you use that particular space. Make sure you're on slide 3 for this one. So I think slide 3 is called Form Must Ever Follow Function. So I'm probably going to say this like 5 more times because you have to know that in relation to Sullivan. So what Sullivan is getting at here is that when you design a building, you're not just designing it for how it looks. You're designing the way it's shaped in order to fit its particular use. So if you're going to need an office space, you have a lot of people in there, if you need to separate these people, you need to make sure that the form separates people. There'd be a lot of different rooms. And so this is kind of like his way to describe like your approach to building something. It's not just about how it looks. It's about what you can create in order to use the building in the way that it's intended to be used. And this will be a little bit more obvious when we talk about that bottom floor that I keep referring to. So Sullivan illustrates his philosophy by describing the ideal skyscraper. So the ideal skyscraper, according to his treatise, is at first there should be a base level with the ground floor. That way, everybody who needs to use the building can get into the building easily. There should be light and open space. So if you're going to enter a building, it should be easy to access. He also says that the second story should be publicly accessible by stairways. These floors should then be followed by an infinite number of stories for offices. They should all be designed to look the same because they serve the same function. Finally, the building should be topped with an attic story and a distinct cornice line to mark its endpoint and set it aside from other buildings within the cityscape. For Sullivan, the characteristic feature of a skyscraper was that it was tall, and that height should serve the goal by emphasizing its upward momentum. By the turn of the century, Sullivan adapted these ideas to a new context, and this department store, the Carson Peary and Scott Building, was definitely different than Sullivan's earlier office buildings. This building was intended to meet its patrons' needs in a different way. Instead of emphasizing basically like a beehive of identical windows meant to reflect the identical work taking place in each individual office, Sullivan instead decided to highlight the lower street level section and the entryway that draws shoppers into the store. This was done in a number of ways. The windows on the ground floor displayed the store's products and are much larger than those above. And this kind of ties to what he said in his treatise about that first floor being open, having public access. All these choices are meant to emphasize that function. This form is meant to make this function possible. And so no matter where you approach the building, the doors and the entryways are visible from all directions, no matter how you approach the Carson Peary Scott building. You can go ahead and move to slide 4. The cornerway entry and the entire bay section are differentiated from the spare upper stories by a unified system of extremely ornate decoration. And when you're looking at a like broad distance view of the building, you might not even notice this extremely ornate decoration. There's cast iron ornaments with highly complicated, delicate, organic, and floral motifs. And those decorations have become hallmarks of Sullivan's design aesthetic. For Sullivan, the decorative program was also functional as well. I know we think of decoration as just like looking good, but remember, he says that form should always connect to function. And the whole purpose of being decorative is to distinguish the building from those around it. I mean, if you've ever been in an urban place, sometimes all the buildings look alike. But when these big buildings all look alike, it might be hard to distinguish what you're looking at. So Sullivan's kind of signature of using like decorative floral elements as decoration near the ground level was something that would help distinguish the building from those surrounding it. And also, because it is a store, it would make it attractive to potential customers. The upper parts of the Carson Peary and Scott building also reflect Sullivan's adaptation of his skyscraper theory to a department store. Each successive story of the white terracotta facade contains identical windows. In this case, a three-section Chicago window that was common to late 19th century skyscrapers in the city. There's an overhanging cornice at the very top that seems to signify the end of the building's ascent. And the slightly setback attic level is distinct from the broad midsection. And it's also distinct from the dark cast iron decoration of the base level. Unlike Sullivan's other buildings, however, though, the building's primary thrust is horizontal rather than vertical. So yes, this building does have verticality, but the overall design gives it kind of like an outward horizontal motion, like a movement. The long uninterrupted lines that go beneath each window from each side basically kind of create that effect. The wide rectangular windows also frame the squat 12-story frame, and they're intended to meet the specific requirements of a department store, where a horizontal window would be more maybe ideal for showing like an expansive space or displaying products to customers, maybe not necessarily accommodating individuals in their office. Some critics like Mumford and Gideon viewed the lower ornamental section of Sullivan's Carson Peary Scott building as an uncomfortable disruption to an otherwise stripped down planar style they favored. Nevertheless, the building's continuous operation well into the 21st century speaks not only to the prestige of Sullivan's name, but also to the sustained value of architecture as a corporate symbol. So your takeaway from this particular building should be that Sullivan's building has an elaborate decorative program. Sullivan paid attention to the functional requirements of retail architecture. Sullivan's design was a remarkably successful display for department store products. Those expansive windows, those horizontal qualities, even though it diverges from the wholly vertical effect of earlier skyscrapers, it still has its own distinguished place in the Chicago skyline. And I think today, it's actually a Target. It's kind of funny. Let me look that up real quick before I end this section of it. I mean, it would make sense. Think about if you go to a Target. You want to walk in. Yes, it is a Target. You want it to be accessible. You want it to be something that no matter which point you're coming at through Chicago, walking towards the building, that you can see a doorway and you can enter in. That's just smart for business. Okay, you can go ahead and move to slide 5. Okay, you should be on slide 5. Now we're going to look at our next building, which is Villa Savoy by the architect Le Corbusier. And the title of this slide connects to a quote from a writing by Le Corbusier where he talks about architecture, and the line is, "The house is a box in the air." And that definitely has a strong visual connection to what you look at here with the structure. So the first thing you should notice when you look at the structure is that it is like a rectangular box in the air. That lower story with the very like simple columns is intended to be something that you don't really notice. He's really emphasizing that top floor. So let's get into this one. So the Villa Savoy is basically in an area of France outside of Paris called Poissy, and it was designed by Le Corbusier in 1929. And essentially, it's a culmination of Le Corbusier's work during a decade in which he really worked hard to articulate the essence of modern architecture. Throughout the 20s, via his writings and his designs, Le Corbusier considered the nature of modern life and what role architecture had in this new machine age. His famous dictum is that the house should be a machine for living in. And he perfectly realizes this idea within the forms, the layouts, the materials, and the way that Villa Savoy is situated. So Villa Savoy, as I mentioned, is located outside of Paris. And the building itself was created for basically an escape from the city, a way to get out of the crowded city. Its location was on a large unrestricted site that gave Le Corbusier complete unobstructed creative freedom. Visually, the finished product looks like a delicate floating box, but it's designed in a functional way in order to be a functional house. It almost looks like a modern sculpture of sorts. And with this site, he elegantly melds both form and function. Go ahead and move to slide 6. So Le Corbusier had been developing his theories on modern architecture throughout the previous decade. In 1920, he founded the journal L'Esprit Nouveau, the New Spirit, and many of his essays published there would eventually be incorporated into his landmark collection of essays, Vers une architecture, which translates to towards an architecture. So this book celebrated science, technology, and reason, arguing that modern machines could create highly precise objects, not unlike the ideal Platonic forms valued by the ancient Greeks. Le Corbusier lavished praise on the totems of modernity, race cars, airplanes, and factories. And the reason that he praised these things so highly is he marveled at their beauty and also their efficiency. He also argued that beauty not only lay in the newest technology, but beauty also was present in ancient works such as the Parthenon, whose refined forms represented, in his view, the perfection of early archaic systems. So I guess you can kind of think of it like the Parthenon for its time was very innovative, and it really was a combination of both beauty and a celebration of the pinnacle of human achievement. And in this way, Le Corbusier is also trying to kind of like break free and have this radical departure of being kind of like that pinnacle, that testament to human achievement through architecture, just like the Parthenon was for its time. So Le Corbusier sought to isolate what he called type forms, which were universal elements of design that can work together in a system. He found these across time and across the world in fields of architecture and also within engineering. The many images embedded throughout the text drew striking visual parallels and eloquently expressed his search for modern perfection through universal forms. So you can think of like the Parthenon as ancient perfection with universal forms. Le Corbusier was striving to be modern perfection with universal forms. So during the 1920s, Le Corbusier designed a series of houses which allowed him to develop these ideas further. And you guys have a picture of that on this slide, slide six. By 1926, he had devised his 5 points of architecture, which he viewed as a universal system that could be applied to any architectural site. The system demanded that pilotes, or slender columns, as you see in the bottom story of Villa Savoy, would raise a building off the ground, and it would allow air to circulate beneath the structure. Roof terraces were introduced to bring nature into an urban setting. And then also, he incorporated a free plan that allowed interior space to be distributed at will. A free facade on the outside would be smooth, and it would be a smooth plane that could be used for formal experimentation. There would also be ribbon windows, which let in light, but also reinforced like the continuity and planarity of the wall. Go ahead and move to slide seven. So the Villa Savoy incorporated these principles and also realized many of the concepts expressed in Vers une architecture. It was made of reinforced concrete. The ground floor walls are recessed and painted green, so the house looks like a box floating on the very delicate Pilotes columns. Visitors arrive by car in true machine age fashion. The stark white exterior wall with its strips of ribbon windows has a remarkably smooth quality. This stands in contrast to the fluidity of the interior, which if you take a look at the interior shot, you can see that we're looking at a multi-story ramp, and it leads the viewer, or if you were within the structure, the person visiting this particular building, on a gentle curving path through a building that is neatly square. When you're looking at the interior, it's also kind of hard to imagine that you are in something so rectilinear and so square, because within we have that curvilinear, gentle, curving path. So this creates a contrast between the sharp angles of the exterior and the plan, and then also the dynamism we have in the interior of the space. And the point of those contrasts is it charges the house with like a subtle energy, that tension created with the regularity of the outside and then also the curving on the inside is what creates that particular sensation. So the ramp from the entrance up to the salon, a formal interior space that flows seamlessly into the roof terrace outside. Le Corbusier treated the terrace as a room without walls, reflecting his desire to fully integrate landscape and architecture. The ramp finally culminates in the curved solarium that crowns the house, whose rounded enclosure appears to be like an abstract sculpture when viewed from below. Seen from the roof terrace, the ramp and the cylinder of the solarium echo the forms of ocean liners. And that was something that Le Corbusier lauded in his writings. Le Corbusier believed in the benefits of fresh air and sunshine, and that's also something that the wealthy patrons of this building believed in as well. And so it was considered to be a leisure event or activity to spend time outdoors. And that's kind of like a mark of the modern lifestyle where you live in a crowded city, but then when you want some leisure time and an escape, you go somewhere outside of the city, like Posey, and you just experience, you know, how wonderful it is to be outdoors in fresh air. So the Villa Savoy's integration of indoor and outdoor spaces allowed the family to spend times outdoors in the most efficient way possible. This house was, in a sense, a machine designed to maximize leisure in the machine age. And just to bring this all together, the Villa Savoy can be understood as Le Corbusier's refinement of an architectural system. It's like his own personal Parthenon, his own personal perfect space. Its essential geometric volumes embody his concept of the type form, and its careful consideration of precession and proportion connect the building to classical ideas. At the same time, Its clean simplicity and its use of concrete evoke the precisely calibrated works of engineering so admired by the architect. This idea of machines and how machines are precise and beautiful and efficient. This building definitely reflects that. The Villa Savoye represents Le Corbusier's reconception of the very nature of architecture, his attempt to express a timeless classicism through the language of this new architectural modernism.